look at 14 verse 53 is where we left off. So you'll kind of observe once again we're in the literary device that Mark uses, this kind of sandwich effect. So he begins by setting the stage with Peter following Jesus, who's been led away. And then he shifts and looks sort of inside of the meeting place to where Jesus is being held on trial. And then at the end, it goes back to a view of Peter and what's kind of going concurrently outside in the courtyard. So that sort of literary device that Mark uses to begin with one idea, tell a middle story, and then end with the idea again. So let's read through, beginning in 14:53. And they led Jesus away to the high priest, and with him were assembled all the chief priests, the elders, and the scribes. But Peter followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest, and he sat with the servants and warmed himself at the fire. Now the chief priests and all the council sought testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. For many bore false witness against him, but their testimonies did not agree. And some rose up and bore false witness against him, saying, "We heard him say, 'I will destroy the temple made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands.' But not even then did their testimony agree. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, saying, 'Do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you?' But he kept silent and answered nothing. Again, the high priest asked him, saying to him, 'Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?' And Jesus said, 'I am. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven.' Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, 'What further need do we have of witnesses? You have heard the blasphemy. What do you think?' And they all condemned him to be deserving of death. And some began to spit on him and to blindfold him and to beat him and to say to him, 'Prophesy.' And the officers struck him with the palms of their hands. Now, as Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came. And when she saw Peter warming himself, she looked at him and said, 'You also were with Jesus of Nazareth.' But he denied it, saying, 'I neither know nor understand what you are saying.' And he went out on the porch, and a rooster crowed. And the servant girl saw him again and began to say to those who stood by, 'This is one of them.' But he denied it again. And a little later, those who stood by said to Peter again, 'Surely you are one of them, for you are a Galilean, and your speech shows it.' Then he began to curse and swear, 'I do not know this man of whom you speak.' Second time, the rooster crowed. Then Peter called to mind the word that Jesus had said to him, 'Before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me 3 times. And when he thought about it, he wept." Okay, so the way we're going to look at this tonight, instead of just walking straight through, let's just take Peter under pressure, and then Jesus under pressure. I think it's a good way to evaluate these two. Of course, as we just read through this, and many are probably familiar with the story, we know how they both respond, one quite poorly under pressure and the other quite well. But Peter under pressure, so he, as Jesus has just described him in the garden, you know, when Jesus prophesied that they're going to stumble, and you know, Peter says, "Hey, if everybody else is going to stumble, I won't. I'll stay with you, even to death." And everyone else says, yeah, we agree. We'll go with you to death. And then Jesus calls Peter, James, John to go further and to pray with him. He says, "Well, would you just stay up and pray with me for an hour? You know, my heart is very heavy." And of course, they fall asleep. And a few times this happens. And Jesus addresses Peter afterwards, and he says, "The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." I think we see that same sort of thing just happening again here. The spirit is willing. Look at Peter. Everyone's scattered, and he's probably like, "I gotta go. Oh, but I gotta stay." You know, and he knows that he wants to be with Christ. He knows he wants to be faithful. He doesn't want to betray Jesus. He remembers, I'm sure, the conversation that's just happened before. I don't want to be scattered. I told him I'd go with him to death, so I need to stay as close by as I can. Albeit stay sort of at a safe distance. And that, I think, idea of safety becomes a bit of an idol here to Peter. But so he follows, right? Peter follows at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest. It may even have been John that helped him to get in to the courtyard. And so he just sits there with the servants and is warming himself at the fire. And it just pauses there on the Peter picture until down in verse 66. So what's happening? Well, Peter's just sort of staying a safe distance, but an attempted allegiant distance, right? He's seeking to do well. His spirit is willing. So is his flesh weak or isn't it? Well, all it takes, unfortunately, is a little girl asking him if he's associated with Jesus. That's all it really took to reveal the weakness of his flesh. And that's kind of unfortunate in our experience too, I think. Isn't it? Like sometimes when you're most determined and you're most ready to go into battle for the name of Christ and for the sake of the gospel, and then the smallest little thing will just sort of expose the weakness of your heart. And that's exactly what happens here. And that's a frustrating reality. If you've been there, it's quite disappointing in our lack of strength, our lack of dependence upon his strength in our walk of faith. But there's a servant girl, one of the most high priest's servants, and when she sees him, it's quite simple. She's just like, you were associated with him, yeah? The guy that's upstairs is one of your friends. You were with Jesus of Nazareth. And he just says, I have no idea what you're talking about. It's like, you're speaking nonsense. And so quite quickly begins this maybe sort of spiraling effect that happens throughout the evening. And we probably experience this too, that sometimes when we begin in that deception or we begin in that lie, in this case, a denial, but maybe when we begin in a lie, it's easy for it to sort of become more complex quite quickly because we kind of have to stick to our story and everything starts getting more and more dramatic around us. And so that's what happens. It's just three quick phases here, but the little girl's recognition leads right to Peter saying, I have no idea what you're talking about, okay? Immediately after that, verse 69, she sort of looks again. It's the same servant girl. She's probably just going about her tasks, doing her things, cleaning up or whatever it might be. And she's like, takes another look. She's like, no, she's persistent, right? No, I know that you are. And she gets some other people involved. She's like, right, guys, this is one of the dudes that was with him. You know, it's not just Jesus that was well known. The people who were close to Jesus and Peter was always by his side. You know, Peter, James, and John would have been, their faces would have been recognizable as well. And as we'll see in a moment, he's from another region than in Jerusalem too, so he's sort of recognizable by that too. But she gathers some other people around, begins to say to those who stood by, this is one of them. But, and his words aren't recorded specifically here, but he says, no, surely not. You know, he denies it again. So we have this round two, the cords entangling him, his weakness exposed, the weakness of his flesh. And then a little later, further into verse 70, other people are involved in the conversation. And they all kind of insist together. Surely, you are one of them. Like, look at you. You're from Galilee. You're not from here. Why else are you sitting in the courtyard? You even have the Galilean accent. Like, we know that you are one of those guys. Why don't you just say it? We all know the truth. It's not like they're up in arms against him necessarily. The threat is pretty low, and his insistence on separating himself from Jesus is quite high. And he escalates here to an even stronger degree where he demands that they all believe something that they know to not be true. He's bringing down curses upon what we don't know. I don't think that's necessarily like foul language, but he's just saying things very, very strongly. He's bringing a curse down on something, and he's even swearing an oath, like, you know, I swear by something highly significant that this is the case, that I'm telling the truth, which, of course, he's doing in his folly. It's not true. And then Jesus' built-in reminder of Jesus' own prophecy sounds off. The rooster crows. And Peter remembers. Another of the Gospels records a look that Jesus and Peter share at this moment as Jesus perhaps is being transferred. And Peter's heart is just absolutely broken, as yours would be and mine would be if this was us sitting in this situation. Not hard to place ourselves here. A few of these principles I think we should take away from Peter, that once this, from the moral perspective, once a lie has begun, it often persists. And so we ought to be careful about sort of first steps, about a careful response, perhaps, in an initially difficult or exposing scenario, maybe a moral principle. But as far as the narrative goes, this is a great low point in the life of Peter, isn't it? Like his name means this rock, and he's supposed to be solid, and he's one of these core members of Jesus' inner circle, and here he is at like rock bottom. You know, it's almost a sad play on his name, where his worst fears are realized. He was the vocal one of the group. He was this sort of almost militant too. You know, we know that he chops. He's one of the sword bearers, and so he's being looked to. So if anyone. He's even said it himself. He's put himself up in this way. If anyone's going to stay by you, I'm going to stay by you. And here, you know, recognition by a little girl turns him away. So it didn't even take an army. Should have taken an army, right? Should have gone down swinging. But it didn't take much of anything. So the question sort of sits in the narrative. Before we mention that, if you can imagine this is your first time reading this, it's a good exercise for us to do in familiar passages. So wouldn't this moment be sort of amazing? Because Jesus, we would be thinking like, oh, no way. Like Jesus just said that was going to happen. And so the fulfillment of Jesus' words, his own prophecies just a few hours before, I think inspire confidence in what Jesus has said. And that the narrative is cohesive. So, like, Jesus has mentioned the rooster crowing twice on this very night, and then that exact thing takes place. That's incredible that Jesus has the ability, of course, to do that, a testament to his divinity and to his messianic authority. So the question sort of sits with us, is Peter now a denier? Because that's certainly what it looks like, right? If you, again, place yourself just at this spot in the story. Say you don't maybe know what the rest of this gospel has to say. You don't know what Acts has to say. You don't know what the epistles have to say. You just know here, like, Peter kind of looks like Judas. I mean, not to the same degree, but he's done a similar thing. He's denied, and so have all of them, really. They've denied association with the one who loved them. So is he ultimately a denier? Is he a betrayer? Is he a forsaker? You know, we look back at chapter 8, verses 34 through 38. Jesus has taught specifically about this. He says, whoever desires to come after me, let him do what? Deny himself, take up his cross, which was that willingness to face death in association with Jesus, and follow me. Well, what has Peter not done? He has not done any of these three things in this moment, right? He has placed himself above denial of oneself. He has refused the cross or anything anywhere close to it. And he's not following Christ. He's running from him. And then Jesus goes on to say, down in 38 of chapter 8, for whoever is ashamed of me and my words, which is exactly what Peter is here, in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him the Son of Man also will be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. So in this moment in the text, like, the sun is sort of set on Peter. It looks pretty bad. And maybe because we know where he goes, this is a helpful moment for us. Because there oftentimes maybe in our doubt or in difficult situations when we lack faith, when we lack belief, lack confidence, we look into our own hearts, we say like, what am I? I'm more like Judas than I am like any of these other guys who follow him. It feels like it's just sort of betrayal, or maybe my coworker put me in this awkward situation, and I didn't know what to say, and I just can't represent him, and I never know the answers, and I have a hard time reading. It's just like, I don't even know, am I even in? You know, maybe things aren't warm in the assembly, and it's just difficult. And you sort of wonder, like, am I even counted among God's people? And will he be ashamed of me? Because it often feels like I'm kind of ashamed of him. Well, then this is hopeful, isn't it? First, because not all of Jesus' words that he prophesied that very night have taken place yet, have they? If you look back in the very text, this is probably maybe an often missed point. If you look back in the very text in 14 earlier, 27 through 30, when Jesus is predicting Peter's own denial that night. Okay, so the sheep have been scattered because the shepherd has been struck and the rooster has crowed and he's denied him three times and all this stuff. What hasn't taken place yet that you see in those verses? Say that again, John. Okay, verse 28. Jesus says, but after I have been raised, then what? I will go before you into Galilee. That hasn't taken place yet, has it? Jesus will go before Peter into Galilee. That's comforting. Look at Peter's failure, but Jesus' promise to him stands. Jesus is going to go before Peter into Galilee, and he will, as he's said before, when Peter testifies that Jesus is the Christ, and Jesus says, yes, and on this testimony I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. Jesus has made other promises to Peter that will come to pass, as he has to us in our weakness of faith. And so, what a moment of hope. There is great hope. Peter did not continue and persist in his denial, did he? No, he goes out and weeps and repents and is very warmly and kindly restored by Jesus not long in the future. And then in time, we have this magnificent sermon at Pentecost as the Spirit of God anoints Peter and his authority. You might even say his flesh grows in strength. His spirit is willing, and his flesh becomes more willing to follow, and it's strengthened in faith and in hope and in assurance and in confidence, because by the end of the story, Peter's not running away when any little girl asks, are you associated with Jesus, is he? No, he's not. He's actually standing before the crowds, and he's taken up his cross, and he's following Christ. So maybe be comforted by Jesus' promise of sanctification, of growth in the faith, that he will keep us to the end, and all that are in Father's hand are safe eternally. So Peter under pressure, sort of a failed moment here for sure, but even in the narrative, we have these shots of hope into what will be. Okay, so now Jesus under pressure, and I want to work through the narrative, but then spend whatever time we have, maybe 15 minutes or so at the end, trying to really dial down on the Son of Man title. It's personally one of my favorite titles of Christ, probably my favorite. I love the way that he uses it, and so we'll just explore that a little bit. So Jesus under pressure. So he's before the Sanhedrin. Everyone's gathered, these 70, this fall, I'm assuming, that evening group of 70 chief priests and elders and scribes, plus one, the high priest. And so there's a lot of questions about the legality of what's going on here, whether they are currently breaking current standards that they have or whether standards sort of came into place following this awful procedure. But they're, at least later and probably presently, they're breaking all sorts of rules as far as when they're having the proceeding, how the proceedings are going. It's like a way worse, obviously, version, but if we were to like have a members meeting and we just completely ignored the Constitution, we absolutely ignored Robert's rules of order, like we just didn't do anything that we were supposed to do because we were trying to get something done. Probably seen that at different points. various ones of you, various places. Where like, because we have an agenda, we're going to maybe bend our own rules to get to that agenda. And that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to get, the mission accomplished would be to accumulate enough evidence against Jesus to take it to the Roman authorities with the request of the Roman authorities issuing a death verdict, right? Because the Jews, I don't believe, have that authority at this time. And so they're trying to gather this evidence. So they bring false witnesses, and none of them seem to be able to agree, and then a few of them do agree, and the best sort of that they have is verse 57 and 58. Well, we heard him say, I'll destroy this temple made with hands, and within 3 days I'll build another made without hands. Like, this is kind of the accumulation of a lot of tension and lead-up, isn't it? Look back over the gospel, see how many times they've tried to trap Jesus in his words for this very reason, so that they can bring solid evidence against him. They've never managed it. Every one of their sort of traps, he's foiled. And whether that's by silence or by a clever question or just a precise answer, whatever it might be, he's always managed it. And even here, their best evidence is a twisting of something that Jesus has said. It's not actually a quotation from him. Because Jesus did not say, I will destroy, that he was going to destroy the temple made with hands. But the closest reference to this is John chapter 2, verse 19, where Jesus says, he just says, destroy the temple, and I will raise another in 3 days. And it's clear in the text, even mentioned various points throughout, they're just talking about his body, that his body is going to be destroyed, and it will be raised up in 3 days. But so the best that they have is sort of a twisted version of something that he said at one point. So they're trying to throw all this stuff at him. Nothing's really sticking. This is a good picture of what it means to be blameless, is that all these accusations are just sort of obviously empty and falling short. And yet the high priest stands in verse 60 and is like, well, what do you say to that? What do you say to all this stuff, all these things, all these people are saying? And Jesus, to fulfill prophecy, namely Isaiah 53, middle of the chapter, as a sheep before his shearers is dumb, so he opened not his mouth. Jesus opens not his mouth, and he doesn't respond. And then this sort of climactic question in the Gospels. So you remember, thinking back through all of these maybe enigmatic moments in the narratives, where after Jesus does something miraculous, he'll sort of veil or suppress, keep a secret, like, don't go tell people that I did this, or the demons cry out about who he is and he tells them to be quiet, or all these different times that he sort of minimize the revelation of his identity, yes? Remember these moments. That is all over here in this moment. So he's before all of the Sanhedrin, and the chief priest asks him explicitly. So it's sort of top-tier authority to the man himself. Are you the Messiah? And then he furthers that by saying, the Son of the Blessed. So the Blessed would be, it wasn't proper to sort of say the name of God explicitly. So this is like a reference to God's name. They'd say the Blessed. So are you the Son of the Blessed? Are you the Messiah? Now, that's a little bit interesting for us, because as we look back and we think like Son of God, he's asking an explicit deity question is what it sounds like. But thinking from his context forward, he's asking if Jesus is the Son of David, if he's asking if he's the Messianic King. And David and God, like God kind of has this relationship to the Messianic seed or to the Davidic seed as father to son. So it's like a reference like 2 Samuel 7:4, where God is saying, I will be his father and he will be my son. That kind of an idea. So this like a father-son relationship between God and the Davidic seed is kind of his question. So he's being redundant. He's sussing out, are you the one promised, is his question. A bit ironic, though, that that's kind of how we look on it, too. And we're like, well, yeah, the Davidic seed is the Son of God. So that's what he's asking. So you can see sort of the tension mounting all through Mark, maybe, to this moment. And Jesus says, in two Greek words, ego eimi, I myself am, yes. So, sort of curtains pulled back as far as who he's claiming to be, it all has reached a peak here. But then, he doesn't stop there. He sort of advances the idea. And he says in verse 62, that's really where we'll spend the rest of our time, I am, and you will see the Son of Man, there's his title, sitting at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven. So, why is the title Son of Man significant? What's really the importance of that title? Now, this is kind of the reason, one of the reasons I really appreciate it, is that if you were to read all through the Old Testament, there's like over 100 usages of this phrase. And it's just a very common way to just refer to a dude, just to a guy, like literally the son of a guy, like the Son of Man, just a human male. There he is. It's pretty, just a normal term. And in the Old Testament, I think this is right. There's only one reference to Son of Man that has Christological implications. It's normally just referring to a person in a story. If you find another one, let me know. But I think there's only one. And it's the one we'll look at in a minute. So, Old Testament, just a dude. Then, if you go to the New Testament and you put aside the Gospels, then we only have four usages of Son of Man. One of them is a quote from an Old Testament psalm. Two of them are in Revelation. And then Stephen is the only person recorded to refer to Jesus as the Son of Man when he's being stoned. He's the first martyr. He's being stoned. And it's in the book of Acts. And he looks to heaven and he says, look, I see the heavens opened and the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of God. So Stephen has now identified Jesus in this way, with this really, what to us maybe is a common, though I don't know if it is a common, we don't normally just refer to Jesus as Son of Man, but if we encountered it in a narrative, we're not tripping over it. We're not like surprised by it or confused by it, really. So outside of the Gospels, four usages. In the Gospels, Son of Man, 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 everywhere. It's packed, loaded with it. This is Jesus' title for himself, his most common title for himself. He references himself. I am the Son of Man, come from heaven. About 80 times recorded in the Gospels, Jesus calls himself the Son of Man. So that's, I think that's why I love it, is that it's Jesus' choice title for him. So it's probably reading into it too much, and it's just maybe my imagination maybe run amok, but if Jesus is reading in the Old Testament as a child, certainly with the view through his humanity, he's studying, he comes across this prophecy in Daniel, which is the single Christological reference, where it references the Son of Man. And that's a great name. That's what I want to call myself. Because you have to know the scripture to know what he's saying. It would be easy for it to just sort of be, as he intended it to be, a mysterious sort of means-nothing title until you see what he's saying. So let's grab a couple references to demonstrate one point. So I might just ask a couple people to look something up. Would somebody maybe raise their hand and read or find Numbers 23:19? We find Numbers 23:19. Gary? Could somebody find Psalm 8:4? Josh? Somebody go Job 25:6? Job 25:6? Steve? And then one more, Isaiah 51:12. Bonnie. Isaiah 51:12. Okay. Numbers 23. Can we read that? Okay. God is not man that he should waver or lie, nor a son of man. Like, God is not a son of man. All right? Job, or let's see, Psalm 8:4. Okay, so what's man that God thinks about him, and the son of man that God would visit him? There's this vast chasm between God and the son of man, right? Psalm 146:3, do we do that one? I didn't get that one. I have a lot more than I gave out. Isaiah 51:12. Okay, why should you fear something like son of man who will be made like grass? Do we do one more, Job 25? Yeah, Job 25. Yep. Okay, so he's comparing God to man. He's like, well, man's like a worm. The son of man's like a maggot. You're not like that. So you see all of the, you see the point. It's pretty clear. It's redundant in the Old Testament. Men are weak. God is not weak. Men will die. God does not die. Men lack wisdom. Men are stupid. God does not lack wisdom. Men are not worthy of your worship. God is worthy of your worship. Don't rely on men. Trust in God. Like, you see this contrast. Son of man is a lowly term. So one of the 2 points that's intended, that son of man is packed with, is first, Jesus is a man. He's one of us. He's a human being. He is lowly. Without a doubt, Jesus intended to communicate his humble humanity when he used the term son of man. He was placing himself low. That's the simplest and the most common meaning of the phrase. So what's the theological reason for Jesus doing that? Why would he pick such a lowly term? Why would he identify with something that, as we saw, is so undesirable and weak and just, ugh? And the answer is simple and sweet. Because Jesus had to be a man to die in our place. So he was emphasizing his humanity, that he could be a substitute for human beings. Hebrews 2:9, and then verses 17 and 18 say, but we see Jesus, who was made lower than the angels for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he, by the grace of God, might taste death for everyone. Therefore, this is 17, in all things, he had to be made like his brethren, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. This is one of the main reasons for his term, Son of Man, is that he would be communicating and putting forward and reminding people of his lowliness and of his true humanity. So, only a son of Adam could die for Adam's race. Right? Death came through a man, and life had to come through a man. Romans makes that point. Wickedness came through a man, death came through the man, and so righteousness and life come through a man. And so the Son of God became Son of Man. So, he is like us. But that's not the only thing it communicates, because of Daniel chapter 7, the single, strong, Christological reference to Son of Man. So we have to flip back to Daniel chapter 7, and The more you explore around in Daniel, the it gets a little crazy in the second half. But he's kind of this kind of lands right in the middle of a vision. Beginning of 7, he's having this vision of four beasts, and then he has this vision of the Ancient of Days, and the four beasts are sort of these wild creatures, and they represent these four kings. And they're all coming out of the sea, and they still have, there's still one of them kind of around when Daniel's vision of the Ancient of Days begins in verse 9. And that's where we want to sort of clue in here. The scene is that the Ancient of Days, as we sung up tonight, it's God himself, is being seated. And it's this heavenly sort of setup crew getting things ready for Judgment Day. And so the Ancient of Days is seated on the fiery throne, and we'll read it in a moment, but I mean, a million heavenly beings, right, are ministering to him, and the court is seated, and the books are opened, and judgment begins. There's still one beast that's raging and is arrogant and blaspheming, and so he's cut down and given to the flame in judgment. But now there's no rulers. And there can't be a kingdom without a king. We need a ruler. And so it's in that moment that the Son of Man arrives. Okay? So let's read verse 9. I watched till thrones were put in place, and the Ancient of Days was seated. His garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame, its wheels a burning fire. Fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. 1,000 thousands ministered to him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were opened. I watched then, because of the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking. I watched till the beast was slain, and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. As for the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away. Yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man. There it is. Coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days. They brought him near before him. Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. Wow, very powerful image, isn't it? That this ruler, the Son of Man, comes to the Ancient of Days, and he's brought, and he's given three things, right? The dominion and the glory and the kingdom that will never end. So he has this power, this appointment as absolute sovereign and eternal judge by virtue of his atoning ministry. The one who is obedient, the one who is righteous, the one who paid the price for men's sins, the one who died the substitutionary death, the one who is vindicated by his life that returned 3 days later, he is appointed as the judge of the entire human race, and he is appointed the king of the eternal kingdom. He's enthroned in glory, and his enemies are subdued, and so the kingdom begins. But this kingdom's not like other kingdoms in that they pass away. This one will never pass away. It is eternal. And so, when Jesus is talking to Caiaphas, and he says, I am the Christ, and I'll make it really clear. You know the one time in the Old Testament, because Caiaphas knew his scriptures, he didn't know them as Maybe Proverbs called him to know them, but he knew them. He knew them intellectually. He knew exactly what Jesus was referencing when he talks about this clouds, this picture of the vision of Daniel. He says, I'll do you one better. I'm the guy from the Daniel vision. I'm the Son of Man. That's the eternal King, and that's me. So while you sit here in your human court and hold judgment against me, I want you to know that there will be a day when we will switch spots. And I will be your eternal judge. That's what Jesus is saying. I'm your maker. I'm your judge. I'm your king. Ooh. So what should Caiaphas have done? He should have done what Isaiah did. He should have done what Peter and James and John did when Jesus called them. He should have fallen on his knees before his king. He should have repented. He should have said, you're right. What are we doing here? Disband this council. This is our king. Let's follow him. But prophecies must be fulfilled, and the Son of Man must die for his people. And so he doesn't. Caiaphas rises in arrogance. Can you imagine this? He's being pious, and he's claiming Jesus as blasphemer. And so he laments, you know, he tears his robe, and it's just all this show before all of these 70 supposed righteous men. Maybe a few among them were. Maybe there's a Nicodemus, and maybe there's a Joseph of Arimathea sitting there. But not very many of these men are righteous men. And he has this show, and he says, what more do we need? We've heard his blasphemy. And then they all start beating Jesus and leading him away and all of this. From a human perspective, you know, absolute blasphemy themselves. And so as we walk away from tonight, we have this gaze at Peter. We saw, like, oh, we see ourselves there and the disappointment, and we're familiar with that, sort of traveled that path many times, but also the hope. The prophecies about Peter were not done, and neither are the prophecies of our faithlessness. You know, he knows his own, even if they're faithless. And the comfort, sanctification, all these things. Then, from the strength of Christ, from Jesus under pressure, you see resilience and the Messiah being magnificent and him revealing himself truly and finally for humanity to see, for the rulers who shouldn't turn, just proclaim his name to the world. What happens? The turn, this dark turn. Their evil and twisted hearts are moving towards manipulating the hearts of even the people to get him crucified, to get him out of the way, so that they can keep doing their little J judging and all their little R ruling, all this oppressive stuff that was benefiting them temporally. And yet we have the hope of the very thing that Daniel prophesied, connected with Jesus' words about himself. We serve the King of an eternal kingdom. And that is magnificent and hopeful and building in our souls as it relates to even today, tonight, finishing tonight well, going home and living for the King as we even put our heads on the pillow and seek to rest, and as we interact with our family, as we get up maybe for work, or we get up for interacting with a neighbor, or we get up for whatever it might be tomorrow. Like, what happened, what we talked about Sunday and what we're talking about tonight, we're serving the risen King of the eternal kingdom. That's awesome. And so go in his strength. Go in Ephesians 6, the armor that he's provided for a difficult taking up our cross sort of rest of our clinical lives. And then we will join him in resurrection. We will join him in this eternal kingdom.
And it will be over,
wonderfully over, for all of eternity. Has begun this magnificent life that we'll get to live with him in this new world together. So, stay faithful in his strength and in his grace till that day. Let's pray, and then we'll sing doxology together.